When we talk about power, people don't know what it means. So power has a very clear and simple definition from my perspective. Power is the ability to command and control. India is right now not a match for China. If we did not have nuclear weapons, China would very much want to fragment India and do whatever it takes.
Some of these people are actually like agents of the Chinese government to understand how the US works, how the society works. They've been embedded there deliberately and been given tons of cash.
Some of them have been accused and actually apprehended because they have been stealing technology and transmitting that to back to the mainland, motherland. Business people have taken over lots of real estate and stuff like that. So there's a concerted effort by the Chinese to infiltrate various nations. I mean, he has the means, the ability to flatten Ukraine in 2 days' time. He has the firepower, the air force, all of that.
छोटी सी अनाउंसमेंट सारे देश के एस्पायरिंग पॉडकास्टर्स के लिए. हमारा टूल प्रो पॉडकास्टर टूल्स इज आउट नाउ. एनीवेयर फ्रॉम प्रोडक्शन, आउटरीच, रिसर्च, डिस्ट्रीब्यूशन, वायरलिटी, ग्रोथ, पोस्ट प्रोडक्शन, सब सिखाया जा रहा है फॉर अ फ्रैक्शन ऑफ द प्राइस दैट यू वुड पे एन एजेंसी. एनीवेयर फ्रॉम स्टार्टिंग टू स्केलिंग अ पॉडकास्ट एंड मीटिंग वीआईपीज अक्रॉस द कंट्री इज अवेलेबल नाउ. प्रो पॉडकास्टर टूल्स, लिंक इन डिस्क्रिप्शन. लेट मी नो एंड आई विल सी यू टू स्टार्ट योर पॉडकास्टिंग जर्नी टुडे. यो व्हाट इज अप माय फ्रेंड्स, वेलकम टू अनदर एपिसोड ऑफ दोस्तकास्ट. मेरा नाम है विनम्र कसाना. आई एम नॉट गोना टेक 10 seconds more and just say this is an episode with Abhijit Chawla. We discuss everything from the Russia-Ukraine war. We discussed India's status as a civilizational state. We talked about everything that you know about geopolitics, concise in a 1.5 hour episode. Enjoy the episode with Abhijit Chawla, because in 3, 2, 1. Welcome to the cooped up life of a podcaster, Abhijit.
Thank you so much for
having
me.
How's it going?
Good.
I had the chance of hanging out with you a bunch in Mangalore.
Yeah.
You and Kushal. Having many, many coffees, many, many great breakfasts, and a great panel at Mangalore Lit Fest.
Yep.
And ever since I've come to know you, I figured you're a walking encyclopedia of geopolitics. The physicist part is covered often, but not as often as geopolitics. People across the world throng to you for your geopolitical expertise. I want to start with perhaps our neighbor, right? Pakistan. Only because a friend of mine called me, "Tere ko pata hai, Imran Khan ko jail hone wali hai."
Acha.
And then, as of today, he is already jailed.
So, he is.
I figured we would start with Imran Khan, his role in Pakistan as this sort of renegade PM figure, and subsequent rise, fall, and the state of instability that Pakistan has had now for since inception.
Mm-hmm.
But particularly, let's talk about Imran Khan. We know that he's a cricketer, right? How was he able to change Pakistan's politics, and why do people still love him despite not having too much to say or prove from a geopolitical or a diplomatic standpoint?
So Imran Khan is this great cricketer, one of the all-time greats. He was probably Pakistan's best ever cricket captain. He was able to bring this bunch of people, cricketers from different backgrounds, together and mold them into a fighting unit. And his last act was winning the World Cup, 1992 World Cup. So the people of Pakistan love him and admire him a lot for that. He clearly has the leadership qualities, the qualities that you need in a leader, to be able to bring people together for a common cause, common vision, and take them forward and win. So he has that. And he, obviously, we know that he always had these political ambitions. So as soon as he retired, he started working on building a cancer hospital in the memory of his mother. And he succeeded in doing that. And eventually, he stepped into politics. And his plank, his entire platform was anti-imperialism. I remember him saying a long time ago on some BBC or something interview that he did not want any aid money from the US, any support from the US. It's poisoned money, that's what he said, right? And he eventually did become the prime minister. And he took Pakistan into the arms of China. So at that time, the Americans had kind of lost interest in Pakistan for some time. And China was making inroads with the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, CPEC, and so on. So Imran Khan tried his best to woo China and bring the two nations closer. And there was talk about the two nations being the Iron Brothers and all that. But we have to understand one thing about Pakistan. Then that one thing is that the power center is never where it seems to be. See, in every nation, especially in democracies, there are extra electoral, extra governmental centers and networks of power. Yeah. That you will see even in democracies. And Pakistan is not a democracy. Pakistan,
You've said in your, I actually was about to purchase a course, but I was looking at some of the things you said.
Uh-huh.
You said that Pakistan is a vassal state of the US.
Yes.
So how is,
So what's a vassal state? I mean, I use the French pronunciation vassal. Okay, what's a vassal state? It's a satellite state. It's a state that has lost sovereignty to a much more powerful nation, and it is allowed to keep on governing itself, but certain policies, etc., are strongly mediated, influenced by the more powerful nation. So, for example, Pakistan. Why was Pakistan created in the first place? It was created as a counterbalance to India and to serve certain geopolitical interests, long-term interests of the UK, of the British. Mm. Now, the British, they eventually became a second-rate power after 1956, the Suez Crisis, and the US became the dominant power. The dominant power became the US in 1944-45 itself. But the British Empire, center of power, moved from London to Washington, somewhere around this time. And then Pakistan came into the arms and the embrace of the US. And the US also saw a great amount of utility in Pakistan as a counterbalance to India, because India was going to pro-USSR, and also to keep the USSR and its tentacles away from the warm waters of the Indian Ocean. So a lot of interests were at stake over here. And Pakistan and the US have this, this agreement which was signed in the 1950s, which kind of defines the roadmap of Pakistan being a US tributary or vassal state. So Pakistan would offer its territory to the US to serve American geopolitical interests. In exchange, the Americans would give Pakistan aid in terms of money, arms, ammunition, and all that. And that played out very well in the 1980s during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan,
right,
where the US funded the Mujahideen, which were a proxy force to fight the Soviets. And the Soviets were never able to cross the Pakistan border, from where all this terrorism and all that was coming in. And that's why they eventually had to withdraw from Afghanistan. So Pakistan is a US proxy. And it was a Chinese proxy as well. So the thing is that when it comes to Pakistan, the real center of power is the army ISI complex, the army, the generals that run the army, and the ISI, which is the intelligence arm of the army, you could say, and also certain very powerful people, the old landlords or whatever you want to call them.
The oligarchs of Pakistan.
The oligarchs, let's say.
The zamindars.
Zamindars and all that. Those powerful families. So it's all intertwined. And that's the real power center. And they have this so-called democratic process in which some prime minister comes to power. And no prime minister, if I remember correctly, has ever completed his or her term properly, that sort of thing. So when it comes to Imran Khan coming to power, he was never in power. In Pakistan, the person who is officially in power is the scapegoat. When things go wrong, and they will, you're going to blame it all on that person. And then...
Right.
And then get rid of the person, maybe hang him like Zia-ul-Haq did to Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, or jail him like Imran Khan is currently in jail.
Or assassinate like Benazir Bhutto.
So it's a poisoned seat. It's a seat that doesn't give you any power. It gives you status. Okay, I became the Prime Minister of Pakistan. But at the end of the day, you're going to be bumped off, or you're going to be, blamed for whatever goes wrong. And things will always go wrong in Pakistan, because the nation, it's owned by the army. The people have no control over what's happening, and the people are essentially resources, expendable resources. So that's how it is. So from my perspective, I just don't care who is in power officially in Pakistan. Who is the prime minister? I don't know. I don't care. It doesn't matter. The policies never change. What really matters is where does the Pakistan army's allegiance lie currently. So the Pakistan army is a mercenary organization.
And really?
Absolutely. 100%.
The armed forces of a country as big and as powerful as Pakistan are a mercenary army to other powers in the world?
Absolutely. So, for example, 1980s, 1990s, we had the end 2000s, 2010s also, and even now, we have Pakistani terrorism that's operating in Jammu and Kashmir. In the 90s and 2000s and etc., it was a tremendous amount of terrorism that was flowing into India. All of that was funded and financed by the US. All right? There's no question about it. There is absolutely no question about it that the US funded and financed Pakistani terrorism in India. For more than two decades.
But hasn't it been an ally on our faces for many, many years now?
So that's how the world works, You're going to work together in some things, and you're going to stab people in the back as well.
Yeah.
And you keep on piling the pressure so that you can coerce your so-called ally to do certain things. That's how it works. So it's at the end of the day, when you take a realistic approach and a realistic view of the world, it's all about power. Every nation has a certain amount of power. So in my course, I call it comprehensive national power. And you can actually... you can actually calculate every nation's CNP, comprehensive national power, based on a number of factors. So typically people think about GDP. When you think about how powerful and how big every nation is, you talk about the GDP ranking. So the US is number one, China is number two, Japan, Germany, India, and so on and so forth. Well, GDP is just one factor. There are a whole bunch of other factors that come into consideration. There's power projection, there is your how strong your army is. Power projection is a very interesting concept, and so on and so forth. There's a whole bunch of factors.
So let's talk about power projection for a sec. Because I also want to tie that into something else. We often think about India as a soft power, right? But I'm not sure what the definition means. And then I was listening to one of your podcasts and you said that the USA is a very openly hard power. What's the difference between the two?
So hard power is all about, see, okay, what's the definition of power? What do we mean by power? When we talk about power, people don't know what it means. So power has a very clear and simple definition from my perspective. Others can disagree, I don't care. Power is the ability to command and control. That's it. Command and control. It's not about pleasing people and influence and what they call soft power, culture, blah, blah, blah. All that is nice to have. It is absolutely worthless without hard power, which is the ability to command and control. Think about, let's say you have a nation that has the most beautiful and advanced culture in the world, but they are paupers. They have terrible living standards. The per capita GDP is abysmal. Is anyone going to respect them? Whoever.
Yeah.
Let's say you have a person who is very well read, okay, very cultured and all, lots of knowledge, but that person is jobless and has no money. And is anyone going to respect that person? That's simply how the world works.
A humanities PhD generally.
So there you have it. So the thing is, so that's power. Power is the ability to command and control. And power projection is essentially how far can you command and control beyond your territorial borders. That is power projection. So there are a number of ways of measuring, quantifying a nation's power projection abilities. One is how much of the global economy do you control. Second is how many extraterritorial military bases do you have. Right, so India, well, I'll just put out a number. Let's say India has 7 extraterritorial military bases beyond Indian territory.
It does?
Let's say it has 7.
Okay.
Take a let's say. I don't know exactly how many we have, but I'll put out a number.
It's a covert information generally.
Open source, I'll say 7. Yeah.
No, because the US is very open source. Right? Everyone knows that the US has many, many bases across the world. And there's no lying about that.
So India, let's say, has 7. 7. Russia, let's say, has 25 beyond its territory. China has 4, let's say. The US has more than 750 extraterritorial military bases on other people's territory.
Wow.
Well, there you have it. That's power projection. The ability to command and control beyond your territorial boundaries.
So when Forbes ranks countries top most, I was looking at the rankings today, top 10 most powerful countries, and I thought Forbes must be reasonable and must have reasonable statistics for measuring that. When they say China is second.
It is not.
So in this way, China is a meager, I mean, it's nothing compared to the US.
Yeah, so I have my very, very clear way of means of, a very clear way of calculating where each nation ranks in the power scale. And China is nowhere close to the US. It's not even a match. It's a mismatch.
So why do we often label China as right next to Russia and USA? What do we get fundamentally wrong about China then?
Well, we look at things from the simple GDP perspective. That's it.
Economically. We just look at an economy.
Yeah, there you have it. So China has the second largest economy in the world. The US, I don't know what it is. What's the GDP?
26 trillion.
26 trillion. China has 17 trillion, let's say.
Yeah.
And Russia is nowhere even close to the US or China.
Yeah, it's around 1 point something trillion.
Yeah, so it's the US, then it's China, then it's Japan, Germany, India, and France, and whatever else. So people look at the world from the GDP rankings perspective because it's the most simplistic perspective we have, and you get those tables everywhere.
Yeah.
So that's why people think of China as an emerging superpower. Well, I'll tell you, it's nowhere near being a superpower. It is nowhere close to the power projection the US has. The Chinese power projection beyond its territory is similar to the Indian power projection beyond our territory. And France has a better power projection ability than India or France. Maybe both of them combined, perhaps, you know. And France itself is kind of a quasi-vassal of the US. So,
but didn't you say in one of your podcasts that the France is actually very antithetical to the US? It does not like the US?
It's a very interesting relationship. So France is part of NATO. It's part of the EU. And both these organizations are dominated or controlled or essentially owned by the US. So the EU is economic political grouping. of nations. Okay, it's like pooled sovereignty. The nations pool their sovereignty together and they lose out on sovereignty because the EU government gets a lot of the sovereignty and the decisions about borders and immigration and whatnot, financial policies, all that. When it comes to NATO, it's a military alliance. So an attack on one NATO member is an attack on all NATO members and everybody is obligated to respond. Okay, so that's the kind of deal you have in NATO. And both the EU and NATO are essentially controlled, created, whatever you want to call it, by the US. So that's where the real power lies. So France, as a member of NATO, is subsidiary. It's kind of lower in the hierarchy compared to the US. Similarly, it's part of the EU, so it loses out on some sovereignty. But the thing about France is that they have a quasi-independent foreign policy. They have their own nuclear deterrent, unlike other nations like the UK. Mm-hmm. Okay, they have their own nuclear deterrent, they have their own nuclear submarines, and they have their own nuclear missiles.
The UK does not have that same
So
thing?
The UK has aircraft carriers, it has submarines, it has their...
Doesn't have nukes?
It has nukes. They make their own nukes. The fun fact is that they use Polaris missiles.
Okay.
Which are American missiles. Which tells you that the big red button is in Washington, not in Rishi Sunak's front desk.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay, that's how it is. And in the past, they used Trident missiles. I don't know. Trident, Polaris, whichever is being used right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about Rishi Sunak because I think he's a fascinating individual. He sort of came to power without an election, was just figured his way through many, many back offices into 10 Downing Street. But in your own podcast only, you said that Rishi Sunak is virtually like a puppet, is an artificial state, just like Canada is. They're both controlled by the US. At what point does the empire start declining and the new Roman Empire, which is also declining now culturally, the US, start coming up?
So the UK was dealt essentially a death blow in the Second World War. The UK controlled this vast territory. They had this entire global network, supply chains, railway lines, you know, shipping lines, all that. They control all the choke points, Suez Canal, the Strait of Hormuz, all those things. But they were dealt a death blow in the Second World War where they became indebted to the US. They were able to hold out only because of US assistance, continuing US assistance against Germany. And eventually what happens is that when the Second World War is ending in 1944, you have the Bretton Woods Conference in the US, in which the decision was reached that the global reserve currency would henceforth be the US dollar. So that would be the currency that underlies the entire global financial system, and the British pound was no longer part of that. Earlier, the pound was the main currency. So now onwards, it would be the US dollar, and all the major Western nations, whether it's France, whether it's the UK, they were under a pile of debt to the US, and the US had the means to enforce the debt. I mean, debt means nothing unless you can enforce the debt, right? So the British were repaying the debt until the beginning of the 21st century to the US. Okay, substantial amounts of debt repayments every year. Debt that was accrued in the Second World War. All the immense amounts of, materials.
With interest.
Yeah. With interest, I'm sure. With interest. Okay, I haven't looked at the specifics, but I'm sure there would be interest involved in this. So that is one aspect of it. Secondly, the British tried one last gasp measure to regain some kind of geopolitical relevance, which was in, I think, 1956 or 58. 56, the Suez Crisis. So the British, the French, and the Israelis tried to invade Egypt and take over the Suez Canal. And they were kind of succeeding. And then the Americans step in and say, out. Out you go. And the entire invasion is foiled. And then that's how Egypt kind of comes on the side of the US. And that was the end of whatever was left of the UK as a geopolitical power.
But why would these three nations, supposedly still comprising the West, go and invade an Islamic country that wasn't posing any harm just to acquire an extra territory?
So it was about the Suez Canal, which is a very vital geopolitical choke point, a transit point.
So
if you want us,
otherwise you have to transit through all the way through Africa,
the
right?
Cape of so-called Good Hope, So it's a shortcut. And Egypt obviously controls, I mean, it owns that. I mean, it passes through Egypt. So what Nasser, the leader of Egypt, did was he nationalized the Suez Canal, which means that he acquired the Suez Canal, which was at that time being run by the British, I think. I think it was the British or whoever it was, most likely the British. They owned that piece of real estate. So he acquired that. He obviously paid them for it, but he took control of that. And in retaliation, these guys invaded that we want control of this. So it was called the spinal column of the British Empire or something like that. It was called at some point in time.
Right, because they control all trade.
I mean, to control India, you have to pass through the Suez Canal.
Yeah. So let's talk about India. I was in Ladakh about 2 years ago, and I was staying at this in this river valley camp. This gentleman from the UK ran it, and he showed me this book called The Great Game by Peter Hopcock. I'm sure you've heard of the book. And it talked about how for many, many years post the World War, all the way till the late 90s or early 2000s, Russia and the UK were playing this dangerous game of trying to get to India via land, right? And they would send spies who would go on long missions for years on end to figure out what's the best way to make it to India via land, right? How is it that India has been protected through all its borders for so many years that the only possible invasions have come either directly through Afghanistan or Pakistan? And you know, what is it about India's borders specifically that these missions that happened for many, many years failed?
So the Great Game was about, you know, about the control of Central Asia, because whoever would control Central Asia would determine who reaches India. So if the Russians took the control of the entirety of Central Asia up to Afghanistan, let's say, then they could straight away make inroads into India. India was the crown jewel of the British Empire, where all of the wealth, whatever was being extracted, was sustaining the British Empire. It produced more wealth and resources for the British than everything else put together. So it was a crown jewel, and the Russians, they wanted a piece of that, and they also craved access to warm waters. If you look at Russia's geography, they have an immense coastline. It's all frozen. The one port
that beaches is in Russia.
And there's one port in the Far East, which is Vladivostok, which also is frozen partially part of the year. So and it's ring fenced by the Japanese and all, which is all controlled by the US. So they crave access to the warm waters of the Indian Ocean, and the Russians wanted to somehow reach out to India. I mean, you know, get a toehold into India's boundaries, and then perhaps take part of India and, you know, reach the warm waters, because that is the one Achilles heel of Russia, that they don't have access to warm waters, and that's why they're not able to trade. It eventually led to the demise of the USSR, actually, if you look at it from a big picture perspective.
Because they were not able to acquire territory that would help them.
Yeah. I mean, the US had access to all the waters, all the warm waters, the Atlantic, the Pacific, the Indian Ocean, everything. The Russians had access to nothing. That is one major factor that led to the decline and eventual collapse of the USSR. Other factors also, I'm not saying it's the only factor, but that's one of the factors. So in the 19th century, there was this great game, they called it, being played out in Central Asia.
It was not the 90s.
20th century.
Yeah. 19th and 20th century?
So there was a continuation of that, a version of that in the 20th century as well.
Okay, it
kind of still exists. Okay. But yeah, at that
time... They're still trying?
There's always something going on. So in the 19th century, there was the Russian Empire and the British Empire. And there was a Crimean War. You know, there's been a war in Crimea recently, 2014, 20, whatever it was recently. Well, there was a Crimean War in the 1850s, I think, somewhere around the 1850s. I don't remember the exact date. The audience can check it out. So there was this great contest for this entire expanse of Central Asia. Whoever will control it can get access to India. And so the British have always sought to deny Russia that. And the reason why the British were so interested in Afghanistan was to hold on to that piece of territory to keep the Russians at bay. Because the Russians had made inroads to all the stans, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, all the stans, which kind of neighbor Afghanistan. They also had some influence in Persia, which is why the British were also very interested in Persia. They wanted to anyhow keep the Russians away from warm waters. All right. So Persia also, I mean, until the Shah of Iran was ruling, Persia was in British, I mean, Western hands, essentially. It was a Western satellite until the Islamic Revolution in 1979. So the Great Game was about control of Central Asia. And there was a tremendous struggle going on there behind the scenes, spies, espionage going on, spies traversing inhospitable territory. I think the Germans even sent a mission to Turkey, via Turkey into India, and they got lost in Afghanistan, something. They offended the Afghans by drinking or something, and that ended in failure because of that cultural aspect of things, and so on. So the Great Game is fascinating. There was a whole lot of things going on in Tibet as well. There was a struggle for the control of Tibet as well. The British sent the Young Husband Expedition into Tibet, I believe, in the early 20th century and all. So it was all about India, actually. But the road to India was through Central Asia for the Russians. And it was all about denying Russia access to India. That's what the Great Game was all about. And a version of that continued in the 20th century as well. The partition of India was also meant to deny Russia access to India. Because if the whole of India gets independence as in one piece, then if India becomes pro-USSR, it's game over. The USSR will get access to India's warm water ports. So create a splinter state of India, Pakistan, which would be permanently indebted to the West for its creation, for its sustenance. And that's how they can always keep on denying Russia access to the Arabian Sea, essentially. And there was uranium also involved in that. I mean, you know, Aksai Chin has uranium. Mm-hmm. I mean, Aksai Chin is in Chinese hands right now. Stalin was interested in that Aksai Chin region and all. The Chinese were interested. So there's a lot of competing geopolitical interests behind all these things. We think of the partition and the creation of Pakistan as a Hindu-Muslim issue, Gandhi, Jinnah. There's way more to that. Gandhi and Jinnah were pawns on the chessboard.
I'm seeing that now. One of the things you mentioned in your podcast is geopolitics has no morality.
There's no morality. Yeah. It's an amoral thing. See, geopolitics is a game of power. And power is just a number. Numbers don't have any morality. And in geopolitics, what really matters, I mean, from the perspective of a nation's leader, you have a constituency, which is your nation. And your job is to serve them and do the best you can to further the national interest. Not the national interests of other nations, only yours. So you're going to do whatever it takes to further your national interest.
Two things stem from that. One is a little weird because it's just a leap that I'm making now. Have you been to Arambol in Goa?
No, I have not.
Have you noticed that there is a strong concentration of Russians in Goa?
I've heard about it.
Yeah, so a movie called Goa, Go, 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 Goa Gone has also covered the Russian mafia in a lot of ways.
Okay.
Do you think the great game is now being taken place through tourists, number one? Because there's a huge, huge concentration of Russians living there, having businesses there, and also having certain control over nightlife there.
I'm not sure if that can have a geopolitical if that can influence geopolitics.
Because they are all near warm water, why in Goa? So
yeah, but they don't have a, you know, it's not just about having a toehold somewhere. You need to have a supply chain. You need to have a trade, a route, which means a railway or a railroad or some kind of land connection through which you can bring in and ferry supplies. So just having an outpost somewhere is not going to be enough.
I see. And the second question is, okay, well, we see that the, you know, Russia does not get access to warm water, the USSR breaks apart. And on 24th February, we're going to go into 2 years of the Russia-Ukraine war, right? I have many, many questions, many, many detailed nuances from that. But just to sort of start off with, at the same time, the NATO is now beginning a large military exercise with many countries, given the recent war. NATO, Russia, do you think there is an imminent crisis happening in the future around these two, one organization and Russia?
The crisis is already on. So what happened, what triggered the Ukraine crisis, special military operation, whatever you want to call it, is the relentless eastward expansion of NATO.
Of course.
Right? So NATO is a power. It's essentially a proxy for the US.
Yeah. It's an amalgam. Treaty organization, right?
It's a treaty organization and it's essentially controlled by the US. So all of these nations, they typically have US military bases on their soil. They will have US soldiers, other soldiers of other nations on their soil. And some of these nations even have nuclear warheads, American nuclear warheads on their soil. And one example is Turkey. It's the one of the easternmost members of NATO. And it kind of sits on top of the Turkish straits, the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles, which is a very important geopolitical choke point. So you have the relentless eastward expansion of NATO. Even though the USSR has broken up, NATO was created to contain or to counterbalance the USSR. The USSR has broken up, but NATO continues expanding eastwards.
Now, when you say expanding, how do we define expanding? It's not like the NATO, which is a treaty of countries, can exactly go to Ukraine and start taking over.
So I'll tell you how it expands. If you look at the number of NATO nations, members of NATO in 1991, you will see a certain line on the map. That these are the nations, mainly Western European nations. And then post-91 onwards, they started adding more members. And those were typically members that were former USSR satellite states, Eastern European nations.
So despite the fall of the USSR, NATO increases its membership.
Right. So they were trying to advance right up to the borders of Russia. And then what will happen is that the US is way far away across the Atlantic. But they will have US forces and US proxy forces right on Russia's borders, which is a tremendous red line. Right? Imagine Russian forces on the Rio Grande border, Texas border. Would the Americans allow that?
The USA would like commit suicide. They couldn't. They wouldn't believe it. Yeah, they wouldn't believe it.
Remember the Cuban Missile Crisis when Kennedy was president. The Russians had placed some nuclear warheads, missiles on Cuban territory. which is not even exactly right next to the US. I mean,
it's a close island.
It's close enough. And they nearly went to war for this.
Yeah.
Now, imagine the Americans putting their soldiers, their warheads, all that, right on Russia's borders. Would the Russians allow it? It obviously doesn't make sense. So that's why the red line was Ukraine. Once the coup happened in Ukraine, the so-called Maidan, Euromaidan revolution, that's when Putin took action and he took over Crimea. And then over a few years, I think he decided that the 2022 is the right time to start taking action in Ukraine itself. So in Ukraine, there is the Luhansk, Donetsk regions where you have ethnic Russians who are the majority. Mm. And they were apparently being oppressed for years. Mm-hmm. So Putin goes and takes over all that. And right now there's a slow war going on. The Ukrainian armed forces have been decimated, devastated. Now they're pressing elderly people, elderly men into service. They're even pressing pregnant women into service, into the armed forces. You'll see that. I'm not kidding. Check it out. Pregnant women fighting on the front lines. That's what's happening.
And and obviously the NATO is funding this, right?
Yes.
The NATO is funding
it's a proxy
this.
War, yes.
Yeah. So are they also sending in forces?
No. They're going to fight till the last Ukrainian is alive. And then the war may move somewhere else. That's what.
So Ukrainians are laying down their lives,
yes,
for the interests of NATO.
Exactly.
What skin in the game does NATO have beyond losing a country?
Nothing. Ukraine is a disposable asset.
I mean, is the US not sending forces? Is the British not sending forces?
Well, they may have sent in some mercenaries or let's say covert forces who would not wear uniforms. Maybe there's been chatter about that, but there's no official uniform wearing personnel of either the US or the UK or any other NATO nation on Ukrainian soil.
They officially must give some funding, some arms, right?
There's a tremendous amount of arms that's been supplied to Ukraine, maybe more than $50 trillion worth of arms.
But the lives lost are Ukrainian.
Not 50 trillion, 50 billion perhaps, or maybe okay. 100 billion. But the lives that are, like you said, the lives that are being lost are Ukrainian lives. Yes.
So why does someone like Zelensky keep fighting this war then? Is he completely a puppet?
Why do the Pakistani generals keep on fighting India? Are they completely puppets? Same thing. See, it's like this. If you want to control a nation from far away, what you do is you install a puppet, mm-hmm, you know, and you give that person and their coterie. See, no dictator exists in a vacuum. There's always a bunch of people around him who act as the enablers, who act right as the power source, power center, the mm-hmm inner circle, the outer circle, and so on and so forth. That's how it works. That's mm-hmm how the power works. So typically what you will have is that this dictator will have certain benefits being given to him or her, maybe a tremendously large bank account somewhere in the Swiss bank or in the US. And at the end of the day, there's a promise that if everything goes to hell, then you can come back and live in the US and do the lecture circuit. Right. Maybe we will give you the Nobel Prize or whatever. And that's it. And that guy is going to do whatever it takes to serve your interests.
So he has a ticket back to the US?
That's what I expect. Or maybe he's been promised that and maybe it may not happen. I mean, people are expendable at the end of the day.
Yeah, I forget. I remember when the Taliban took over Afghanistan,
uh-huh,
we heard about rumors of the then president leaving in a jet to somewhere.
1 year.
Seeking safe haven.
Yeah.
So what about this exercise then? The NATO is beginning a large exercise and what's going to be the consequence of this?
It's just saber rattling. It's to keep your troops sharp, keep them active, and keep reminding your adversaries that we are capable of so and so. We have certain capabilities, and so it's all about keeping on reminding the adversary that we are mm here. We are capable of so and so things. We have these many troops, and yeah, we exist and we are there.
Like in Hindi, Shakti Pradarshan.
Shakti Pradarshan. So yeah, you know, flex off your muscles and all that. You keep on doing that periodically.
So this morning, Tucker Carlson, formerly of Fox, now exclusively on X,
yeah,
has reached, I believe, St. Petersburg or Moscow. He's reached Moscow to interview Vladimir Putin.
Mm-hmm.
First time an American journalist has gone to sort of break away from national guidelines and interview the head of state of a country that the US is tacitly fighting through the NATO. It's an important junction in the US because one of the things he mentioned is that this war is being fought on your taxpayer money, right? So what I want to ask you from here is that what will Putin do? What is going to be his end game? Because is he not sticking the lives of his own personnel, his own soldiers, his own country, his own alliances, his own economic resources, all on a war that really has no end. At least as a civilian, I don't see what's the end of it.
So the thing is, okay, first of all, Tucker Carlson is going to interview Putin, or he has interviewed Putin, I'm not sure.
He's going to interview him.
Okay. Yeah, a couple of years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, Oliver Stone interviewed Putin. A series of interviews. He's an acclaimed
filmmaker, right?
The filmmaker, yes. Yeah. The JFK guy. So he had done that. That was interesting. So yeah, the point is this. See, Putin didn't start the war. Yeah, obviously he launched this special military operation. But he did that when he had no choice. When NATO had reached essentially his doorstep. They had encroached into Ukraine. And they had, conducted a coup and placed a puppet in power. So that was the red line that he could not allow anyone to breach. So that's why he was forced. His hand was forced. And he had to do this. And the alternative was you will have NATO forces right at your borders.
Yeah.
Your soldiers will be face to face, staring eyeball to eyeball with NATO soldiers. And you may have, NATO nuclear warheads right across the border. That's something no self-respecting nation can allow. So that's why his hand was forced and that's why he did it. And when it comes to the war strategy, he's employing a very defensive, very slow strategy. He has the means, the ability to flatten Ukraine in 2 days' time. He has the firepower, the air force, all of that. He can do that, but he has chosen not to do that. Mm. I mean, you still have parties going on in Kiev. You have people partying in Kiev as if there's no war going on.
Really?
Yeah.
The airspace is locked for commercial flights.
I'm sure the airspace is locked for commercial flights. It's no one flies through that except once in a while an Air India plane goes through that. But overall, it's fine. But yeah, there's a very slow war going on. It's a campaign of attrition. Mm. What they're trying to do is to cause as little damage to infrastructure, all that as possible. Obviously, some of that is happening. I'm not saying there's no damage to infrastructure. Some of that is going on. Mm. But they're trying to minimize it. And they're trying to just suck the Ukrainian armed forces into the meat grinder, like the media likes to call it. Mm-hmm. And attrite as much of that as possible, having as little casualties from their side as possible.
So lost by exhaustion?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, yeah. Once the armed forces are depleted, what fighting will they do? And then NATO will have one of two choices. So give up Ukraine or send their own forces in, which would be a disaster.
So if they send their forces in, what's going to happen? Then it's going to be an open declaration that these countries are against Russia?
No, everyone knows they're already against Russia. But it would be a very dangerous line to cross to send NATO forces into a non-NATO nation. Ukraine is not a NATO nation. It's not a member of NATO. And if you send NATO forces into a non-NATO nation to fight Russia, that's going to be a declaration of war, and then anything can happen. And then there is obviously the thing that Russia has this doctrine that if any Russian territory is under imminent threat of being lost, then the nuclear option is on the cards. Then they can use the nuclear option. They can start tactical or whatever. But once you launch a nuke, all bets are off. So nobody wants that. Nobody in their right mind wants to do that.
Okay. So last nukes in the world, probably Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
I hope so. I hope it never happens again.
So Hiroshima and Nagasaki is when the world actually saw the last nukes being used, right?
Yeah.
It's been many, many decades since. I feel like the end point of all wars is the threat of nuclear arms, right? At what point does a country actually say, fuck it, let's take up nukes? At what point does it happen? Do you think in our lifetime we're going to see that? And second, have countries gone very close to pressing the button, but they've been stopped by other forces?
Yeah. So in the 1960s, in 1969, there was this tremendous border dispute between the USSR and China. Hmm. And there were these border clashes along the Ussuri River in the Far East.
Okay.
It was called the Ussuri River incident or clash or whatever you want to call it. Hundreds of soldiers on both sides died. Okay, there was almost a full-blown out war. And the Soviets had decided to nuke China. They had decided that. And the Americans caught wind of this. And they threatened the Soviets that if you do this, we're going to nuke you. We're going to come to the rescue of China. And that's what prevented the Soviets from nuking China.
But they had decided this.
They had decided. Yes, they had taken the decision. The Americans stepped in, intervened, stopped this from happening. And that led to the US-China detente. And Nixon and Kissinger visited Beijing, met with Mao. And that's where the Chinese start opening up their economy. And that's what created the world that we live in right now. Okay, so the Soviets had decided to nuke China at that point in time. They were really afraid of China because China has this vast territory and this tremendously large Red Army. Just numbers, sheer numbers.
Yeah.
And they were worried that the Chinese would flood their Far East with Chinese troops and then the Russians would lose the territory. So they had taken this decision, but the Americans stepped in and stopped this from happening. So that was a point in history where the world came really close to nuclear war. The other was the Cuban Missile Crisis, where once again you had daggers drawn and nuclear missiles could have been set off at the slightest provocation. And there were certain incidents also where people mistook something and thought it's a nuclear missile launch, but sane minds prevailed and no retaliation was taken, and then it turned out to be a glitch in the software or whatever, the system. So there have been instances in the past where we have come very close to nuclear disaster. Now, what would make a nation want to or decide to use nuclear weapons is the question. So we can take it case by case. The Israelis are an undeclared nuclear power. They probably have around 90 or so nuclear warheads. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And the Israelis have a very clear doctrine or whatever, what they call the Samson option. The Samson option is that if all of Israel's neighbors bunch together and decide to invade Israel, and if Israel is on the brink of losing everything, then they're going to launch the nukes and destroy everything. So we go down, but you also all go down together. That's the Samson option. So no one survives. Okay, you're going to kill us, but we're going to ensure that none of
them survive. This is a policy that they have.
I'm sure it's not written somewhere, but it's pretty much known that they have the Samson option. When it comes to India,
this is a military maneuver, Samson?
Samson was one of the mythological figures or historical figures.
Yes.
So he brought down the walls of a temple and, killed everyone with himself, that sort of thing. Then when it comes to India, we obviously don't want to use nuclear weapons ever again. Mm. Right? But under what circumstances would you possibly imagine that India could use nuclear weapons? I would only imagine that we would do that if our territorial integrity were under threat and our existence as a nation itself would be threatened.
If China and Pakistan combine somehow to attack us from the north.
And let's say we are on the verge of being overwhelmed. Hypothetically, if we are in the situation.
Like if Delhi is overrun, for example.
Yeah, something like that. If Delhi is on the verge of being overrun and India's armed forces hypothetically are on the verge of being completely overwhelmed, in that case, I suppose we could use nuclear weapons. And then you may destroy us, but we're going to ensure nothing of yours also survives. The Chinese have worked their backsides off for decades to build up whatever they've built. We can, evaporate that if it comes to that. So it's a lose-lose scenario. Using nuclear weapons is a lose-lose scenario. Nobody wants to do it. So the point of nuclear weapons is deterrence, that the adversary knows what your red lines are, and they obviously, if they are sane, they won't try to cross those red lines.
Yeah. So with the, like we said, so, okay, let's just say Putin decimates Ukraine and takes it over completely and it reincorporates it as a part of Russia. Let's just say.
Uh-huh.
What's the end game then? Where does Putin march from there? Does he stop the war, sign a treaty, get some punishments from the West? Because, in the International Court of Justice, South Africa has condemned
Israel.
Yeah, Israel.
Look, so what is Putin's end game is a good question. I don't think he wants to decimate and flatten Ukraine.
Yeah.
There's no point capturing a country that has been flattened and there's nothing left. Because then you have to rebuild the whole country using your own economy, your own manpower. For example, if China were to take Taiwan, but it would just take a smashed out, smoldering ruin of a country, what is it going to gain? It won't gain anything, actually, beyond a piece of real estate. So I think Putin's end game is to ensure that Ukraine becomes permanently neutral. He will obviously reincorporate some territories like the Luhansk, Donetsk regions, perhaps even march on to Kiev and maybe do a regime change there, put a puppet president over there.
It used to be back in the day?
Maybe like that.
Yeah.
So Ukraine historically is Slavic territory, Russian territory. Ukraine means the borderlands. Borderlands of what exactly? Borderlands of Russia. What else? So historically, it's been Russian. Slavic. The Slavic people they speak a bunch of Slavic languages.
Uh-huh.
And the major language is Russian. Serbian is also a Slavic language and so on. So I think the end game is to ensure that Ukraine becomes permanently neutral. Some parts of Ukraine will be reincorporated or have already been reincorporated into Russia. Maybe there will be a partition of Ukraine east and west. Maybe Kiev becomes neutral and there's a puppet president who is pro-Russia over there. And maybe the western part of Ukraine could go and reintegrate with whatever nations are to the west of Ukraine. Because historically...
And NATO retreats?
Or NATO will have to retreat and he's going to ensure that by force.
Hmm.
Not through a treaty. Treaties can be broken, but force is real.
I mean, it's going to sound very simplistic. How is it that a treaty becomes an organization? I was looking at the full form of NATO. It says North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Okay, so look, a treaty is just a piece of paper. Okay, it's a charter. And there are, so it's a military alliance, essentially. You can give it whatever name you want. You can call it organization, treaty organization. You can call it an alliance, whatever. It's a military alliance. And the whole fundamental underpinning of that is that it was created to counterbalance the USSR, which was rising very rapidly, which was a major power. And it brought all the nations of Western Europe together into one alliance with the US as the big daddy, as the big partner. And the fundamental underpinning was that an attack on any of these nations was to be regarded as an attack on all other nations. And if you attack one of the nations, everybody else will respond collectively together. Mm-hmm. So that brings all the nations under a single block. It kind of pools the military sovereignty, etc., under one single command. So all these nations that are part of NATO are under a centralized NATO command. Okay, and technically it's all like, you know, you have sovereignty, you retain sovereignty, but you give your some portion of your armed forces under this command and so on. But actually, at the end of the day, the most powerful nation controls the alliance,
yeah,
which is the US. So NATO is an organization. It's also an so the foundation of the organization is the treaty which they signed whenever it was the organization was founded.
Yeah.
So it's an alliance. They can give it whatever name they want, treaty, ally, organization, or whatever. But it's a military alliance controlled by the US. That's what it is.
Got it. There is talk now from pretty much many news outlets here in the country about India's rise as a global superpower. A superpower, not really, but like we are now in the midst of an India story, right? Our EAM seems to believe it. Our Prime Minister seems to champion it. Indians overall in the country are feeling this upsurge of positivity, this upsurge of pride about who they are. And they are no longer seeking as much validation from the West. At least that's what I've come to believe through reading stuff and speaking to people. I met up with a former CNN employee at a bar because he was friends with a friend of mine. And I said, what does the US media show about India? He says, when they cover the international news, they mostly cover wars. They don't cover India. We don't like the Prime Minister because of these and these reasons. And I thought to myself, are we really being fed a great India story through our own news outlets and through all pro-India outlets? But actually, geopolitically, we're not scaling up.
So India is not a superpower. Let's be very clear about that. And I don't think either the foreign minister or the prime minister have ever said that India is a superpower or an aspiring superpower.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't think they've ever said...
No, not superpower. I mean like the India on the rise story.
Yeah, it's that is definitely there.
Yeah.
So if you look at the statistics, if you look at the data,
yes,
India's GDP is rising. It's the fastest rising large economy in the world. It's the only economy that doesn't have any chance of recession next coming few years. As the economic strength grows, so does the military muscle. It's a proportionate factor, right? And India's power projection abilities are expanding. India is conducting maritime operations all the way to the Gulf of Bab al-Mandeb, the near the Red Sea. Between the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea, where the piracy is happening, mm-hmm. in the east coast of Africa, we are, you know, apprehending pirates and saving various ships and vessels. We're doing that. We are part of various multilateral organizations like the Quad, like the I2U2, and so on and so forth. We have brought Africa, the African Union, into G20, which is now G21.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see that the relevance of India globally is rising as India's economy grows and as the world gets, you know, tries to move away from China because of a multitude of reasons. Now it's China plus one. That's a policy every nation has. So then they're looking at India.
What's the policy? China plus one? What does that mean?
China plus one is that means that, see, all the major Western nations right now use China as the manufacturing base, right?
Mm.
Because, it was very
cheap. It's the factory of the world.
The world's factory and all that. But now the cost of manufacturing in China is rising and the Chinese government is clamping down on a lot of things. And there is the added dimension of trade sanctions and trade barriers and all that, the CHIPS Act and all that. So they want to move away from China and invest in a different country which is more closely aligned to the West, or at least not openly hostile to the West.
Hmm.
So India is the natural place where you would go to because it has a massive population, a massive potential for manufacturing and all that. So there is that. India's economy is rising and India's geopolitical footprint is rising. India's you could say military footprint is rising. So if you look at all of these factors put together, and if you were to plot a graph of India's overall power, it's definitely rising. So India is definitely a power that's rising. By 2030, it will probably be number three in terms of overall power globally after the US and China. But India is right now not a match for China. The only unfair advantage we have is that we have nuclear weapons, which kind of keeps China at bay. If we did not have nuclear weapons, China would very much want to fragment India and do whatever it takes to fragment India. So India currently is not a match in terms of raw power, even for China. India is a regional power, a growing regional power. Give it 20 years, we will be a match for anybody in the world. But it's going to take time. So we are a nation on the rise. We are nowhere close to being a superpower. We are not even close to being a challenge to China right now. But we are a long-term threat to everybody if they want to think in terms of threats. So India is not a hegemonic power. India is not an expansionist power. The fact that India is conducting naval, maritime operations, military operations in the Gulf region, in the Middle East region, it is actually something that has greatly enthused the Middle Eastern countries like the UAE, Saudi Arabia, etc. Because they know that we're not going to go and, you know, invade them next week. But it's also something that gives them some kind of cover, because until now it was only the US that had a naval hegemony in the region. Now we have the rise of India. India is a friendly nation to all these Middle Eastern countries, and it's kind of a counterbalance.
So why are we not expansionist? Is it like, what has prevented us from being expansionist?
I'll tell you why. If you start being expansionist, then you're going to start wars. You're going to get embroiled in military conflicts here and there and wherever. And when you get embroiled in military conflicts, a lot of your resources go into that. And you want to use those resources to build up your manufacturing, build up your economy.
And then maybe fight fours in 100 years.
Become a $30 trillion economy. Fir sochenge, then we'll think of. I'm not saying we should do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's first, you know, first cover the basics. Then we can think of everything else. And it's not like we want to fight the world. Why should we? We just want to have a stable, peaceful neighborhood and live our life the way we like to live it, without others telling us what to do or interfering in our internal affairs.
So why are we not a threat to China beyond the nukes? Like, is our manufacturing not at that level? Do we not have the same bilateral relations with other countries? Or perhaps our military power is, when we do the comparison between the two, we're astoundingly at a low number?
So there's a number of factors. First of all, we are a $4 trillion economy?
Okay.
The Chinese are 17 or something. 17 point something trillion dollars. Okay. So they are more than four times as large as India. Almost five times as large as India economically, the GDP, okay, gross domestic product. Then if you look at the Chinese military budget, what is it? It's about $270-300 billion, roughly, okay, give or take. I'm not sure what the exact figure is. It's a multiple of what India spends. India spends maybe $80 billion, maybe let's say 100, and the Chinese spend $300 billion. So that's a factor of three or four right there. So if you look at the amount of resources they're spending in, you know, investing in military development, it's way more than India. Their economy is way larger than India. The size of the nation, the population is more or less the same, comparable. The size is so much bigger. They have so much more resources at their disposal because of the size. And these are the factors. When it comes to power projection, India is kind of on par with China. Okay. And when it comes to the international order and the way India is regarded and China is regarded, people, other nations kind of regard China as a threat. Okay. They respect the fact that China is so powerful, so big economically and so on, but they see China as a threat, and they see China as a nation that wants to exploit them in some way or the other.
So wherever, and it's got evidence of that.
There is evidence of that. They have used all this debt trap diplomacy with various nations. For example, the Hambantota port in Sri Lanka, they finance that port. That port is completely unviable. Nobody uses it. But now, because the Sri Lankan government was not able to repay the loan, the Chinese have acquired that land on a 99-year lease. So they have acquired a piece of Sri Lankan sovereignty.
I see.
And the same story exists in various parts of Africa and all that. So the Chinese have this predatory policy of giving loans that cannot be repaid, you know, and then you take over some part of the nation's sovereignty and territory.
Wow. So they act like a vicious loan shark, and then they take over.
Like a loan shark. Exactly. Yeah.
I see. And they also do lots of cyber warfare, no?
They're quite good at that. Yeah. They've been very vocal also about that we can do this and that. And yeah.
I actually had a roommate in college, a housemate in college rather.
Uh-huh.
And he was working with this US think tank on their radio program.
Uh-huh.
And preparing programming for understanding US and China relations. And I think he got in too deep, rather too deep.
Okay.
And we were sitting on the porch, on our porch in Boston, on one random afternoon. And a message popped up on his screen. Some random Chinese alphabets. The screen turned black. He said, "You've been hacked." And some joking emoticons came around, and his laptop was dead after that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and after that, he completely stopped investigating China. This was in, this was in the summer of 2018.
I see.
Many, many years. But that one incident
mm-hmm.
proved to me also about just the number of Chinese people who live in the U.S.
Oh, yes.
As, you know, they come in as international students
mm-hmm.
or they come in as, you know, unsuspecting migrants. And some, he told me that some of these people are actually like agents of the Chinese government to understand how the U.S. works, how the society works. They've been embedded there deliberately and been given tons of cash.
Yeah, that's pretty strategic, actually. If you look at the if you look at Chinese students who come to the U.S., you would say that they are very strategic in the kind of departments they go into. They'll go into departments related to various technologies, you know,
mm-hmm.
niche technologies, important technologies, and they'll try and get into positions of power and influence within these departments. Not just as students, but they'll become faculty. They'll rise into
yes.
positions of power, and you will see Chinese origin professors everywhere in all these technology departments and all that. And some of them have been accused and actually apprehended because they have been, you know, stealing technology and transmitting that to back to the mainland, motherland, uh-huh. whatever it is. And Chinese business people have taken over lots of real estate and stuff like that. So there's a concerted effort by the Chinese to infiltrate various nations, whether it's the US or Canada or wherever you have sensitive technologies. Even Australia, they have done that, you know. And they use various kinds of techniques. Sometimes they bully the Australian politicians and government in certain ways. They have been caught trying to honey trap various U.S. senators and politicians, that sort of thing as well. And they also have these tremendous cyber capabilities. So in the early 2000s, there was this series of coordinated cyber attacks from China into the U.S. The Americans called it Titan Rain, T-I-T-A-N, Titan Rain. And the Chinese extracted tremendous amounts of very sensitive military blueprints and information, of fighter plane blueprints, etc., which I think the F-22 or F-35 or whatever it was, and the Chinese now have a fighter plane that looks very much like that, and much more. So the Chinese have tried all kinds of measures, and they have been extremely successful at various levels. And like you said, they have infiltrated the U.S. at various levels and things like that. And of course, yeah, if you are digging too deep into China, they may actually hack your devices and send you a warning, a friendly warning. Get yourself a new laptop and don't try this again.
Is that why the Indian government bans so many Chinese apps? Because yeah. that's... In fact, that is something that is lauded very well by other countries when they talk about India.
That's right. So our government has banned a whole bunch of apps in several tranches. The first go, it was more than 80 apps, and then there were like two or three more sessions of banning a bunch of Chinese apps. Mm-hmm. So what the Chinese apps do is that they essentially, you know, leech out all your information, all your personal data, and they keep on sending this data back to their home server. Mother server on a routine basis, so they know exactly where you are going and whatever your movements are like, uh-huh. and what your preferences are, and obviously that helps them create a certain kind of demographic footprint and kind of a demographic map of the people of India, those who are using Chinese technology, you know, whatever Chinese cell phones exist, even if you're using an Apple phone, for example, if you have Chinese apps, then they may be able to steal your information and keep tabs on you and all that. Of course, if you use an Apple phone or America, you know, Android phones, the Americans may be able to do the same thing.
Of course.
Yeah, so it works in both ways.
Yeah, but we always see because of the great PR that the West has done, we always see the West as less nefarious than China.
Yes, that's right.
From there, I've also noticed that, you know, in the UK as well, especially in student governments and in colleges, Pakistan also sends its students or its elites to mm-hmm. study there and then rise to prominent positions of power.
Yes.
Is that also a way to sort of influence UK society and make sure that Indians, they counteract Indians there in the intellectual sphere?
So this is something that is being done probably at the behest of the UK government, even Canada.
And really?
So I'll tell you what. So the UK has always been very pro-Pakistan and very anti-India. It's always been part of the history because they created Pakistan as a counterbalance to India.
And this is despite the fact that there are more UK-India bilateral talks, events, summits happening all the time.
Doesn't matter. They prefer Pakistan. So what they do is that they place Pakistani students in prominent positions, give them a prominent voice, and you see this all the time. You know, Pakistani origin students rising to positions of power as student leaders.
Yes.
And things like that. You will see that all the time.
Especially
in the UK. Okay, so you will see them in all the big universities, Oxford, Cambridge, all that. Student leaders or student president or whatever they call it, you know, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. So that's something I probably believe is being done by the US by the UK government. It's a well thought out strategy to kind of marginalize Indians, make them less visible, make their voice not marginalize their voice, and bring the Pakistani voice to the fore, so as to construct various kinds of narratives and you know about India and about Pakistan, that Pakistan is the victim, Pakistan is on the is justified in whatever things it's fighting for and all
because
that.
Because the think tank class, you know, gets their education in the UK. So then they can also import that back to their own country, and then that allows them to then at least have one more outpost to shape global narratives about Pakistan.
It also allows them to identify potential future collaborators from the Indian student pool, those who are not fighting back, pushing back against that, but actually collaborating and going ahead, going along with the narrative that's been constructed.
Yeah,
so it's a great feeder ground, no?
No, but like in that way, an Indian student listening to a Pakistani speaking about Pakistan's influence from a point of curiosity could also be co-opted in this. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And it's like if you don't go along with the mainstream narrative, you're going to be marginalized. But if you want to, if you're ambitious, if you want to rise to a position of power and prominence, you may as well as play along with that. Mm-hmm. Some people will put aside their national interests and their allegiance to the nation and go and play along with this. And you have so many such people that that are part of the think tank circles and all in the West, especially, who are Indians, but they write all kinds of anti-India articles and stuff like that. You know, propaganda, contribute to the propaganda.
I wonder what kind of person would it be to start doing anti-India activities abroad? Like, is it just money? Is it the?
I'll tell you what it is.
What?
To some extent, it's money, but more than that, it's prestige. So
prestige from the enemy?
Prestige from the West, not from Pakistan. Who cares about Pakistan prestige? Prestige in the West. You are in a prominent position in a prominent university in the West, maybe in Sweden, maybe in Norway, maybe in the UK, maybe in Canada, maybe in the US. You get invited to all these major conferences and you are given a position of honor in these conferences. And you travel business class and you are part of the limousine and champagne circuit. I mean, what else, what is there not to like about that? Don't you think?
I never thought you're
quoted by the BBC, by the CNN.
Yeah, as a legitimate expert on all things South Asian and Indian, of course.
Yes, absolutely.
Of course, that's there. Which reminds me, you know, something that you retweeted from this man called Subhash Kak. I was looking at a Twitter. I figured it would be nice to bring it up, especially on the context of students. Now, he said, it is dangerous to wholesale introduce Western liberal arts programs into India without critical analysis. Adapt only what is good and true and reject what is bad and wrong. This is because the universalism of the liberal view is a thinly disguised successor to attitudes of European imperialism and racism.
That's right. So when it comes to the humanities, when it comes to the liberal arts, it's all about narratives and propaganda. So in the West, the
but
view...
But all of it? Is there no saving grace in the humanities here in India?
In India? What humanities do we have? We have departments of humanities that, if you look, let's talk about the Indian humanities departments. Go to the website of whatever university you would like, okay? For example, take one of the IITs. These days, even the IITs have humanities departments, sociology and whatnot.
Which is a hard science, typically, yeah.
Indian Institute of Technology, and they are giving master's degrees in sociology and history and God knows what else. I wonder why. I mean, that's money that's being allocated to science and it's being used for this. Anyway, so go to one of these departments online, okay? Check out the faculty and check out their research interests and what they're publishing. What are the topics that they are publishing about? And you will typically find it's about, caste atrocities, caste oppression, majoritarian oppression in India. It's all about creating atrocity literature and atrocity narratives about India and portraying India as a nation that is... inegalitarian, oppressive, and majoritarian, or Brahminical, or patriarchal, or misogynistic, or backward, and all that. It's all about creating those narratives. That's all they publish. All of these so-called professors and all that who have PhDs and who are guiding PhD students in all these humanities departments. That's all they are doing. I mean, India is a gold mine for sociology. There are so many aspects of India that are fascinating. So much culture, so much history, so many traditions. What is the symbol? You know, the meaning of various traditions. What is it? What are the historical roots of that? What is the purpose of a certain ritual, tradition, or custom, or whatever?
Yeah.
And there's so much in that. You know, you can bring in intersectionality of history and invasions and whatnot. You can bring out whatever in that. India is fascinating from that perspective. I mean, take a simple small state like, for example, Jharkhand. Take a state like Assam. Take a state like any far eastern, northeastern state. There is so much to explore in that from a sociological perspective. Mm-hmm. But all they want to do is explore the oppression narrative. That's all they do.
Yeah.
So when it comes to India's humanities departments, all they do is they create atrocity literature and atrocity narratives, which is then used by the West to justify what they the kind of narratives they are creating about India. Now, when it comes to the Western humanities departments, you will see, for example, you have all this open courseware on YouTube. Right? You can see all their lectures, all their courses, whatever it is. Yeah. So they will have, master's degree or bachelor's degree level courses on various religions, world religions. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to a course on Islam, you will have a person who is a Muslim, who is a professor, who's going to teach the students about Islam. Okay, it's going to be very respectful. They're going to go deep into whatever Islam is. Judaism, you're going to have a Jewish person who will do that. Okay, when it comes to Christianity, whatever, it's going to be a Christian person. When it comes to Hinduism, it's always going to be a Western white person who's going to teach the students about Hinduism. Yeah. And you will see that the tone is very different. It's not respectful. It's kind of mocking. So that's the attitude and the perspective from which they approach our, culture. So what do you expect? So what Dr. Subhash Kaki is saying is very absolutely right. So if you're going to bring in US universities or Western universities into India, they're going to continue doing the same thing over here. And it's going to give them more access to Indian students, very easily manipulate, influenceable Indian students who are open to suggestion and all that. It's going to be very easy to influence them and make them, condition their way of thinking and their way of looking at their own culture. So it's obviously a very dangerous thing. Secondly, when it comes to the US, when it comes to the West, the entire humanities and liberal arts ecosystem, academic ecosystem, has been taken over by what they call the message, the woke agenda. We know that. It's been taken over by the leftists. It's a phenomenon that started in the 1950s and 60s, and now it's widespread. It's pervasive. You bring that in, it's going to create more trouble in India. I mean, we don't need to wholesale swallow whatever they're peddling. So it's a very legitimate concern that Dr. Kak has raised over here. And it's something that the Indian government should take very seriously. We are in the process of opening our doors to Western universities to open campuses in India and give their degrees through Indian campuses. But I think we should be selective in what we allow them to do. We definitely want better educational opportunities when it comes to science and technology. Yeah, we do want that. But why do we need to learn their philosophy and their worldview when it comes to the fine arts? Don't we have fine arts and all that of our own? Don't we have our own philosophical systems that we should teach our students and maybe export worldwide? Why don't we do that instead of, taking that over here?
Yeah, usually when people, I remember going to philosophy classes in college and one was to learn Western philosophy. But then philosophy classes in college that had Eastern philosophy had to be labeled as Eastern philosophy.
Oh, yeah.
The rest was just philosophy.
Universal.
Yeah, universal.
So the Western values and Western philosophies are universal.
Yeah.
Everything else is specific.
Yeah. It has to be labeled African philosophy or
yes.
Eastern philosophy for that matter. Yeah, I guess you're right because, I've had friends in here in the North, Ashoka University and General Global Law University, two very coveted universities in the country. What I found in is many cases, they often import community college trash to come in as legitimate professors that would never even dream of getting into a lowly state school in the US.
Mm-hmm.
But here in our formidable universities, they teach full-fledged courses. And sadly, because we often assume ki gora bol raha hai, theek bol raha hoga,
there you have
so
it.
No problem.
That mental conditioning is still very much alive in India.
Mm.
The idea that if you have white skin, if you are from the West and if you speak with a certain accent, you are automatically superior. Mm-hmm. And you automatically know everything. And what you say has to be the gospel truth. So you bring in all these substandard individuals and you position them as professors and scholars and experts in India. And all these students are like, yes, sir, you must be right. And that's how you brainwash entire generations of students. Yeah. And it's really unfortunate that the so-called top universities in India are following this trend. And something has to be done about this. Yeah, and standards have to be raised.
Yeah, also, like, I've just noticed from a very informal standpoint, in many interactions, when someone white comes in, yeah, someone from America, mm-hmm. you know, it has to be the best white, you know, the most prestigious white. I've seen many times acquaintances of mine will direct all conversations to appeal to the American.
Mm-hmm.
And the American will have a very bored, plain look, mm-hmm. as if like nothing really satisfies him or her. And then something takes him apart and all of these people are then fawning over him. Now, I'm not saying this is all Indians. I'm not saying this is all Americans. But generally, I've seen that. What I would like to see now from Indians is that, considering our country is rising in all these factors, we also start taking accountability in social situations and not explaining everything to the American in American words, but having the other person come on and say, what do you mean by that? I think we've been explaining ourselves away too much and watering ourselves down too much to the rest of the world because we want to be accepted and seen and be looked at in a kind and pitiful manner by the West so that we get their funding or their validation. But I say no more to that. I say we should flip the script now.
I totally agree. We in India, lots of us still are conditioned to seek validation from the Westerners, from the white people, especially Americans, the best white person, like you said.
Hmm.
And the reason for that is pretty simple, actually. If you take an average Chinese person and an average Indian person, the Chinese typically won't seek validation from the Westerner.
Hmm.
The Indian will. And what's the reason for this? There has to be a simple root cause. And the simple root cause is that the quality of your demographics, the quality of your individuals, is directly proportional to the quality of your education system and what is taught right in there. So in China, they have a very good education system. They've invested trillions of dollars worth of money in the past 3 or 4 decades into the Chinese education system. They have inculcated a sense of pride and identity in among the Chinese that we are a civilization in our own right. We have our own values. We have our own way of doing things. And the West is not necessarily the best. And the West have oppressed us. And we're going to fight back. And we're not going to portray ourselves as victims.
This is taught to Chinese kids.
It is taught to Chinese kids. The century of humiliation. That's what's taught to every single Chinese kid.
It's called the centuries of humiliation?
The century of humiliation. The opium wars and all that. The 19th century and all the way up to the Second World War.
Okay.
Yeah, all okay. that. So that's the century of humiliation. And the Chinese students, they ensure that they are aware of this. They are aware that the West has historically done this to us, and they are made aware that we are a civilization in our own right. We are superior to the West, is what they are taught, and so on.
Really?
Yeah.
We've never been taught we're superior.
We have never been taught about the existence of India as a civilization in its own right.
Yeah.
That itself is non-existent. We don't know what India is. Is India a piece of geography? Is India a nation, a kingdom? Is it something that was created in 1947? What is India? We don't even teach our kids what is India. Hum log kaun hai? Who are we? Who are the Indian people? Nothing is taught. We don't have a sense of identity. We don't have a sense of pride in ourselves. So that's why we automatically seek validation from whoever is portrayed as goody-goody in Hollywood. And that's how it goes. So it's all about the education system. Reform it. The education system is trash. Mm. Absolute trash. And whatever, what new education policy or whatever, it's like putting a band-aid on a gunshot wound. We have to totally revamp the education system. Well, yeah.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I think there is much to be done. When I saw many of my friends talking about India as a civilizational state, I would never understand it because I did not know what it meant in the first place. I just figured, okay, well, now what's happening is the right has found a new thing to say, okay, I mean, India is a civilizational state, so let's keep talking about that. But I've never explored this education angle, right? Like, I never knew that China is told actively that we're superior to the West. I can never imagine in my entire life any teacher of mine, not to their fault, telling us that we're superior.
Yeah.
We are always taught this, okay, we were a colony, we were the crown jewel of the empire, we were, you know, marginalized and we were basically slaves to the empire in a lot of ways, and now we're on the come up. But the come up to where? The come up to some pride, the come up to mere existence. The idea that we can be the best, and we are the best, I think this idea will take multiple iterations in education and multiple people talking about it.
Yeah. It'll take time. But we have to start somewhere. We have to understand what our past is, because without a past, you don't have a future.
Mm.
So what do we aspire to be? That's the question. Do we aspire to be okay? Do we aspire to be average? Maybe slightly better than average? do we aspire to be the best? I mean, what do we aspire to be? What standards do we hold ourselves to? Yeah. Right now, I see that the standards of the average Indian are very low. I'm not saying that I am the best and everyone will rise up to my standards.
Of course.
I'm saying everybody has to rise to the fullest extent of their potential. To the maximum, to the maximum extent of their own potential. First, discover what your potential is and then try to live up to whatever you can as best as you can. And if everyone starts raising their standards in that manner, India will be transformed. But to do that, we have to first understand what we were in the past. I mean, we are taught the past 1,000 years of history, which is all disaster after disaster. But what was there before that? We never taught that. I mean, we accounted for more than 33% of the entire world's GDP. We had golden ages. We had empires that encompassed enormous territories, including Xinjiang and parts of Central Asia and Afghanistan. Gandhar was part of India. We are never taught any of this. So we need to be taught our true history, first of all, so that we understand where we are coming from and where we are today. Now ask yourself, we were there and now we are here. What happened in the interim? And what can we do to kind of try to reclaim what we once were? I'm not saying go and expand and conquer all territories, but try and be better than what we are today.
Yeah, power doesn't have to be territorial expansion alone.
Exactly.
It can also be the expansion of the minds of people living inside the territories. You know, in one of your podcasts, you talked about artificial states versus civilizational states, right? I found that very fascinating. So you said that Russia, China, and India are civilizational states.
Yes.
And America is a fake artificial state. So so is Canada. That grouping is very like polarizing, or I would say like many might consider it offensive.
Sure.
But I would love your help to understand what is a civilizational state exactly.
Okay. So what's a civilization as compared to a nation? So currently, we have this paradigm, the Westphalian model, the Westphalian paradigm, in which every political sovereign unit is a nation state. But when it comes to the past, we didn't have nation states. We had kingdoms, we had empires, and we had civilizations, and then we had vassal states and all that. So a civilization is an entity which is a large entity, which lasts a long time, and which has certain traits in common. It has a single unifying culture, which may have local manifestations which look different, but overall it's a singular culture with a common and uniform set of values.
Okay.
That's one thing.
Historic examples?
India.
India.
Okay. If you
Mesopotamia
at a certain point. Egypt, for example. Egypt was one civilization. Okay. Greece was a civilization. China is a civilization. Russia, you can say, is a civilization. So one large geographical area, which kind of could encompass multiple sovereign nations, multiple sovereign states or kingdoms, but it has just the single culture, a single culture. It also has a single unifying civilizational language, which not everybody may speak, but when you interact with people from other places
they kind of understand.
They kind of talk to each other in that civilizational language. In India, it was Sanskrit. Even the Chinese, when they would come to India, they would converse in Sanskrit and so on. So in India, we had that. And a civilization is historically a net exporter of culture, not an importer of culture. It has cultural influence beyond its borders. So look at India's historical influence. All of China was Indianized over the past 2,000 years. The Chinese kings used to fight each other. They used to go to war for the possession of an Indian scholar. Kumarajiva is a great example. Chinese kings went to war so that they could have Kumarajiva in their court. And that Indian culture which went into China was eventually transmitted to Japan. So the Chinese called something Chan, which was Dhyan. It went to Japan, they call it Zen. Zen is also Dhyan. Okay, so much of the Japanese culture is founded on a bedrock of Indian culture. Okay,
it's visible in their art. It's very visible.
Yeah, their gods, goddesses, Benzaiten, Kangiten, all Indian gods and goddesses, all the Indian gods and goddesses, Hindu gods and goddesses are part of Japanese Buddhism. And you see that in China as well. And Southeast Asia, Suvarnabhumi, thousands of years, Indianized completely. The high point of Indonesian civilization history was the Majapahit Empire, which was a Hindu empire. And the Indonesians still, you know, hold that as the high point of their history. So Indian civilization spread far and wide. It was a single unifying culture, but different languages. But when you met people from various parts of this entire geography, you would speak to each other in Sanskrit. Okay, so that's how it was. So India was a net exporter of culture. Even Greece was a net exporter of culture. The Romans absorbed Greek culture wholesale.
Right.
Egypt was also a net exporter of culture. So these are some certain characteristics that are inherent to civilizations as opposed to nations. So only a few entities historically can claim to be civilization states. Mesopotamia came and went, it's gone. Egypt came and went, it's gone. Greek civilization is dead, by the way. It doesn't exist anymore. Slavic civilization kind of exists in the form of Russia. Chinese civilization kind of exists in the form of the Chinese Communist Party run empire. And Indian civilization kind of hobbles along under the secular state. So that's where we are today. So and when it comes to artificial nations, that's another distinction, right? That's the controversial part that people will not like. When it comes to the US, look at that geography, that territory. Where, what was it like 500 years ago? Who lived there? The natives.
Right.
The Native Americans. They lived their own life over there in their own way. Then you had the European invasions, and then you had settler colonialism. Uh-huh. So these people, they brought hundreds of thousands of Europeans onto this territory. They settled the territory. They elbowed the natives out. Wholesale massacre. At least 56 million natives died, Native Americans. Okay, that's not me saying. Check out the published articles. So what was done was a population replacement event, and whatever was left of the Native American population was relegated to those
reservations.
And they said that we have given them land of their own and they can live almost sovereign lives there. Go and see the conditions there. Do they have access to electricity, sanitation, plumbing, water? Are they allowed to come out of the reservations? Getting off the reservation is a trope, right? Don't get off the reservation. Stay on reservation. That sort of thing. So they have relegated, marginalized these people to the status of second class, third class citizens. And the entire nation, the US, has been created artificially out of stolen territory, settler colonialism. The same goes for Canada. The same goes for lots of nations in Latin America. So these are artificially created nations with a bunch of immigrants.
Right. Would you say most of Latin America is just Spanish settlers?
Yes. Spanish, European Italian, Spanish. Look at Argentina. Most of them are of Italian origin, strangely enough, even though they speak Spanish. Check out the history. Messi is an Italian surname, you see. So many of the people who live in Argentina today are descendants of Italian settlers. Okay, but overall the dominant language is Spanish. So all of these nations were created artificially through immigration from Europe, and typically you had a bunch of immigrants coming from various parts of Europe. So there is no single ethnicity, there's no single language. Obviously the language in the US, the dominant language, is the language of the Anglo-Saxons, who were the major colonizers. So it's English. So these are artificially created nations. There is no actual rooting in the ground, in the soil. It's just a resource to be exploited, and that's how they use the land today, you know, just ever increasing expansion westwards, and then they reach the Pacific Ocean. Now what do? Now we dig and frack and churn out the oil and pollute the water and all that. And that's how it is. And then we move on to Mars and nuke Mars, I guess.
Yeah, I'm just blown away by this definition, because, wow, like I'm not even taking these countries seriously anymore because of what you mentioned.
No, you got to take them seriously because they are so powerful. They are a real force. They are the dominant force in the world today. That's the fact of life. So you got to respect that. You got to respect power. But this is the truth. I mean, this is an undeniable historical facts.
Awesome. So, like always, I want to say thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You are perhaps the single most available reservoir of all this information in one person in the country right now, and thank you for broadcasting your thoughts about all of these things to the rest of the country and the world. And I'm just glad to have you as a friend and as someone who speaks about these things, because I had a lot of themes I wanted to cover today, and you offered insights in the 3x what I was expecting. So thank you. I'm gonna get your course. This is not like we didn't discuss ki hum course ko karenge, mostly because on the way here I was listen to your podcast again and again, and I really like how you mentioned the civilizational state and the fake states and vassal states and all these other things, because it helps cement the current standings of countries very well, you know, from a historical standpoint. So overall, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for having me here.
Thank you for having me on the podcast. Thank you so much.